Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Now, each week, as you probably know by now, we hear from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week, though, we bring you a very, very special edition of the programme. We're going to sit down once again with one of the remarkable and inspirational thought leaders at the forefront of innovation that UBS supports and celebrates through its Global Visionaries programme, and he and I will be joined by a man with perhaps a unique perspective on achieving extraordinary things under often equally extraordinary pressure, the Formula One world champion, Lewis Hamilton. Mark Pollock, a friend of this programme, is the global visionary. Mark lost his sight aged just 22, and 12 years later suffered another devastating blow when a fall from a window broke his back, leaving him paralysed. Mark and the Mark Pollock Trust now campaign and fundraise to find a fast-track cure for paralysis. Fresh from a fifth world title and ahead of what's sure to be a thrilling new season in pursuit of more glory for him and his record-breaking Mercedes AMG F1 team, Lewis Hamilton joined Mark Pollock to talk to me at Monocle's HQ here in London. First up, well, I had to ask Lewis how his world had changed since the conclusion of what, by any standards, was a pretty remarkable season last year. Surprisingly, or perhaps not so surprisingly, he had this to say.
Nothing's really changed for me. We had the Mexico Grand Prix, which is where we won the World Championship, but we still had the two races afterwards. So everything just stayed in its usual rhythm and same flow. Still had those two races to do. And then even since the last race, which I was relieved to get the race done and it was a successful weekend, since then, still had those usual commitments for sponsors, etc. So you're still kind of, it's still all ongoing. But it's really not until you get your off time where you're with family and you get to kind of reflect on how great a year it's been. But I have had a couple of moments where I'm like, wow, it's been an unbelievable year. But I think it's really not till you're sitting in front of the fireplace or just sitting with the kids, just my sister's kids, just reflect on how great it has been.
And Mark, that's interesting. I wonder if there's a sense of an appreciation of that, the degree of consistency almost that you require, the determination, you know, five world championships. Those are qualities that you'll recognise perhaps better than anyone. It's quite striking how calm Lewis seems about it. But again, you must be familiar with that same, you're remaining relatively sanguine. You need to do that. If you want to achieve your goals, you have to have that kind of steely determination. You recognise that, presumably.
I do recognise it, but not as a five-time world champion, very much in a different context. It's, I suppose, what's interesting and what I do see parallels in is whenever you are a version, a character version of yourself from the outside, like, you know, I went blind, then I fell out a window and broke my back some years later. And in a way, those are two major moments in my life, and in some way they therefore must entirely change you, but they don't really, or I hope they don't.
No, definitely.
So it's kind of like, it's interesting that we all think that you must have changed as a person,
yeah,
because
absolutely.
You've hit that height, but
it
you're still the same
it,
person.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, you're still going on in your day life and you still remain focused and still have goals and you move on to the next one, you know?
Yeah.
Well, to that point about ambition and a degree of, I suppose, competitiveness almost, do you think those are almost innate qualities? And I wonder, you know, going back even to when you were school, Lewis, you know, if you were doing a game of chase in the playground or doing a kickabout with your friends, were you one of those kids where you were going to end up on the winning side of those games? Was there a sort of a winning mindset almost that you had from as far back as you can even remember?
Well, I was chasing girls from a very young age. I was very determined.
Winning mindset.
No, but yeah, man, I was just competitive in everything I've ever done. I always find it really intriguing when people comment to people when they've, you know, if they set themselves a goal, but they've not fully got exactly to where they wanted to be. And they're like, yeah, but you still did it. And they ask you to be grateful for what you have achieved. But the thing is, when you're motivated and when you're so driven to succeed and to excel, you're not going to be satisfied until you've got to where your goal is. You know how that is. But I've always just been super competitive in absolutely everything. Since the day that my dad, we used to go to Blockbusters on weekends, and he used to, when we come out of the Blockbuster store, he'd be like, I'll race you to the car. I was like 5, 6 years old, and he'd always beat me to the car. He'd never let me win. So from that, I was like, I'm never going to let anyone win. And I think it's just instilled in me since a young age.
And Mark, I guess sport has an amazing power to deliver, doesn't it? That, and you've done so many sporting achievements, whether it's in rowing. I don't even know if it's sport. It's almost like endurance athletic events, I suppose, are the things you excelled in even after you lost your sight.
Endurance is an understatement.
Yeah, well, yeah.
43 days.
Well, this is it. 43 days in the Antarctic sort of, well, wilderness, I guess we could call it. Is sport uniquely well qualified to bring the best out of people, do you think?
Best and the worst. I mean, you see all sorts of versions of this. I think sometimes the idea of being competitive or being a competitor, it can have negative connotations. Some people see it as a selfish endeavor or that in order for one person to win, someone else must lose. And in sport, I suppose in a way, you can study it. Sort of abstract in a way, you can look from the outside in and someone necessarily like Lewis does win and therefore other people have to lose. But just to take it in the context of sport and not apply it to the wider world, I think the danger is that we can think of competitors as just being selfish and negative. In my case, whenever I went blind, I felt that I was going to necessarily have to sit on the sidelines as a spectator. And over the following 10 years, I didn't realize I was doing this, but I realized that I could be a competitor again and did all these adventure races, eventually racing to the South Pole. But what I discovered along the way that the competitor, like racing your dad to the video shop, you know, the competitor is pursuing success, risking failure. And the way I came to make sense of it, having the fear that I was going to have to sit on the sidelines, it didn't have to be that way, that I could be a competitor, pursuing success, risking failure. But for me, importantly, being defined by my willingness to try. Because I think the guys who came second and third and fourth and the teams that you beat, you know, they're all out there. They're all doing their best. They're all trying. It's just sometimes people come up on top.
Mm. And Lewis, to that point about success becoming almost dangerous in a way, precisely because you're putting yourself in the line to take these kinds of risks. You're there to be knocked down. And I guess the more success you have, you're not just a four-time champ, you're the five-time champ. The risks almost become greater. How do you go into looking ahead to next season? Because, you know, people will be gunning for you even more now. Do you just use that to sort of galvanize your team and galvanize your own sort of positivity going forward?
Well, I think it's an interesting thought. I mean, failure is inevitable when you're on a journey to getting to wherever it is you're targeting. And I think it's the failure that actually spurs you along. It also helps build character and the foundation of which you're able to then continue to build. For me in my career, it's not been I've just won everything. I've had a lot of failures, a lot of shortcomings, and those have really helped shape and round me as the competitor I am. But I love how sports really does, you know, firstly, it brings people together. So, for example, for me, I do get to work with a massive team. And right now, my season's only just finished. I'm already like, okay, how can I be better for next year? There were things this year which, whilst it was my best, you know, year of my career, there were still shortcomings. There were still weekends where I wasn't able to deliver. There were still weak areas. So how can I rectify those? How can I keep what I have, but add to that super solid foundation that I have? And that's what sports brings to people. It brings, you know, it does bring the best and the worst out of people, because geez, I don't like losing. If there's any sportsman in the world that says man or woman that says they like losing, I think they're lying.
Yeah.
You know, like, and maybe they can put it off with a smile in front of the camera or whatever it is, but when they get back in their room, or internally, you're feeling the pain, you know? Yeah. And that's the great thing that encourages you to get back up the next day and push harder or push that extra rep when you're working out, which is awesome.
There's a kind of Silicon Valley saying stolen from someone else about, you know, fail fast, fail often, fail better, you know. And I think sometimes you hear people talking about it like failing is the end goal. Like, and so, you know, we learn so much from failure that therefore must be the goal. It's not.
No.
Success is the failure. But I think sometimes people can embrace that saying far too much and think, you know, that's what they got to be going for.
Definitely.
You know, and you learn so much from failure that therefore you should stop there. But of course, it's, as you've just said, it's really only as a to inform the ultimate success.
Absolutely. I think it takes sometimes for people less time and some people a long period of time to understand that the failure is a part of it. You know, when I was six, I didn't realize when I was losing to my dad that that was just making me stronger naturally, you know, and it's something that you learn over a course of time.
Well, there's a sort of truism about sport and about life, I guess, that you learn more when things are stacked against you. And I wonder, Mark, do you subscribe to that? You look at some of the sort of catastrophic impediments you faced along the way. It's hard to believe that they can be inspirational, but I guess you're proof positive that you can take those things, the biggest setbacks, and turn things around and insist that you're going to deliver what people will literally tell you in your case, these things are impossible. And you say, no, they're not. Do you always learn more when things are really, really hard, do you think?
I don't know. Let's see in the answering of this question, Tom, whether something comes out. I don't know. Certainly in my situation, there have been two very obvious points or crucible moments in going blind and then more recently breaking my back. And I suppose the way I've come to make sense of it is acknowledging that in some cases you can choose the challenges that you take on. You know, and often in sport, as Lewis just said, you know, you sit down and you say, what are we going to try and go for next year or the next 3 years, the next 5 years? So some challenges we choose and then other challenges choose us. Mm-hmm. And what we can control is what we decide to do about them. Yeah. What I have learned or what I've been able to confirm over the years is that that is indeed the case. And I suppose that as a foundation, focusing on the decisions that we make in light of the challenges, wherever they come from, is kind of the starting point for me. And looking ahead, I now, as I make an effort to cure paralysis in our lifetime, that hasn't been done before. All the scientists and technologists around the world have been unable to do that up to this point in history. But we believe that in fact, curing paralysis in our lifetime will be possible with enough of the right people having the will to make it happen, mm-hmm. focusing on success, knowing that that has the very real possibility of failure. But there's something in the foundation of all that, that lots and lots of people have to make the right decision enough times to ultimately get to the goal. If we were just here with paralysis cured for everyone worldwide, I would leave all of those learning opportunities for failure well behind us.
You know? I think that's a very good answer.
I'm intrigued by, you know, through these experiences that you've gone through, how did you initially react mentally and how did you overcome it? That's a super inspiring factor. I mean, you would have had a down moment, I would imagine.
Oh, without a doubt. Yes. Without a doubt, and I still do. And I suppose if I go back to the blindness, and I think I only, you know, this is sort of retrospective justification of my reaction, because I only heard about this woman, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, sometime after I went blind, in fact, about 3 or 4 years after I went blind. And she studied, you know, her upbeat title of her book was On Death and Dying. And it was how people, family members of people who had terminal illnesses, how they responded. And it was around initially the five stages of grief: denial, anger, blame, bargaining, and acceptance. And I've got some of those right and some of them wrong. But the point is, we do all of these things all the time. And when I, in the aftermath of going blind, I certainly denied that it was happening initially, even though I couldn't see, because you don't want it to happen.
Sure.
You're angry, frustrated, you're looking for some medical science to blame for it, sure. You know, someone to blame for it. You're looking for some kind of a miracle. You're trying to digest it, even though you've already denied it, and feeling sorry for yourself, the sort of, if not depression, certainly a slump.
Yeah.
And eventually somehow some sense of resolution or acceptance that this is the new start point. And I think only the acceptance can only really come once you start to have, I often use the quote, he who has a why to live can bear with almost any how, which is not my own, it's Friedrich Nietzsche. If you have a why, you have some reason to get up in the morning, something to go for, you can start to get out of bed and go for it. But all of that is mixed up, running in parallel, not in order. Mm. But I certainly did all of those things that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross describes.
Let's talk a little bit about a different kind of pressure, I guess, but it connects with what you've described in your experience, Mark, and that's of being inspirational, being an inspiration, being viewed as a leader. And Lewis, you obviously are cited as an inspirational figure for so many people. that's a considerable responsibility, but you both seem to wear it very, very lightly. And I wondered, is that partly because through doing inspirational things, you get to see so many other things, you get to hear so many stories? Liz, I know you've done things as a UNICEF ambassador, you've seen people who have all sorts of challenges they face. Is seeing those stories one of the things that makes it easier to be viewed in that way? Does it feel like a heavy responsibility being an
inspiration? No, I don't see myself as inspirational at all. I don't get the... I see individuals like Mark and my younger brother who's got cerebral palsy and people who are going through far, far more difficult and challenging, which I think also unbelievable situations, and coming out so strong. I find these individuals inspirational. I don't see myself at all as inspirational, but I meet people along the way who happen to have watched me race. And I met this girl and lady in London through a hallway, and she's like, oh, well, I was 2007, I was going through cancer and you got me through it. And I'm like, what do you mean? You know, you were racing every time you came on, and the way you raced, the way you fought through, that helped me get through. And I'm like, I had no idea, you know? So it's cool that it had that effect, but you did that yourself, you know? But it's quite interesting how people sometimes utilize something else to energize them or to help pull them along or just get them over the hurdle, but they do 98%, 99% of it on their own. And I don't see it as a burden. We've all got one life, and I'm very, very fortunate to be doing what I love. And what's crazy is now is I have this platform, the more, you know, a lot of people that are watching and listening to the things that I do and don't say. And I just really try to portray the right image, you know, particularly for young people who are trying to be successful or do something or find purpose in their lives. I think that's perhaps where people like myself and Mark can really, that's something that people can look at us and kind of attach to or feel something in common with, within that desire and that dream and the destiny.
And Mark, I wonder if we can talk briefly about the Mark Pollock Trust and its work. You've painted sort of big picture about the ambition to find a cure for paralysis. I suppose one of the great things is if people are inspired by you and your story, you can point them to find out more about the trust, to support its work, to get involved. Is that one of the great things, I guess, about where you find yourself now, is that you can galvanize people, you can bring them together, and you can prompt them to participate and actually do something concrete to try and help this cause that you're so passionate about?
In my community of people who have a spinal cord injury, you know, I'm constantly trying to balance the opportunity that I have personally with the support that I've got with the responsibility to others who don't have access to the research. So what I kind of think about it is did the South Pole explorers 100 years ago when World War One was going on, was there any value in going to the South Pole? Is there any value in what people are doing now going to Mars whenever people all over the planet don't have enough food and all of these other things that are going on in the world? And I suppose what I try to do with my getting out of bed, going to the gym, walking in robotic legs, trying to create collaborations with scientists and technologists that haven't been done before, you know, that is very much at the fringes of what's possible. It sits, and I get to work with people that I view as modern day explorers working in labs all around the world. And I personally have access to all of their technology as it tries to battle its way out of the lab and commercialize and get to the clinic. And what we're trying to do is focus on that part of the equation that I think is exploration, with the idea that if we do that well, we can help the scientists and technologies to translate their work to the millions of people around the world who, as I say, don't have access to any of these technologies and are just trying to get enough care or get back to work or deal with their injury whatever way they can. So I'm constantly asking myself, is there a legitimate argument for exploration? And I have to argue back with myself and say there is, there has to be, you know, and that's kind of where we're working.
And I think there's so many interesting things happening at the cutting edge of technology. And obviously, Mark, you're exploring this very specific, very focused area. Lewis, I guess the cutting edge of technology is your stock in trade. You and your team are looking at pushing the envelope constantly, season on season. Do you subscribe to this idea that actually technology can answer all of these problems? I mean, presumably you're an advocate of investment in the future and the power of technology. Are you excited by what that future looks like, I guess, on the track, off the track, wherever you look?
Yeah, I mean, I love what the advancements have been so far, and watching, for example, the technology that I work with, seeing it in advance, watching how advanced it is, and the ideas that come from all these different super intelligent scientists and engineers that, for example, we have in our team, who the scientists, they work on the chemicals for the car, the fluids, and that, you know, in our gearbox engine and hydraulics. And then you've got the engine technology that's advancing. We've gone from a V12 to now a V6 turbo, 1.6 liter V6 turbo engine that outputs over 1,000 brake horsepower, which is kind of crazy. And before you know it, it's going to be electric hybrid cars, hopefully probably in the next 10, 20 years. And so it's amazing to see that technology and be in a period of time where technology is advancing as much as it is.
And at the risk of asking a flippant question, I guess when people talk about mobility advances, they often talk about driverless technology. I don't know. I'd like to ask one of the best drivers of all time. Yeah. What about driverless? I mean, we won't ever see driverless F1, will we? That would just be like scale electric.
For me, that means the racing driver's obsolete. So I'm not particularly for it currently, but I'm
You're
sure
ahead of the curve.
Yeah, I'm ahead of the curve, fortunately. But
it couldn't be a human though, could it? If there's sort of a super F1 racer and they said, look, this is all the best technology. It's like in chess, they would say, this computer will beat the world champion. You'd back yourself, wouldn't you? Always?
For sure. Yeah, well, because technology, as Mark was saying, I'm ahead of the curve. Technology is nowhere near gonna be an advance enough in the sense of AI. Whilst a computer or a simulator can do a perfect lap, judgment and feeling and emotion, that's something that currently can't be tuned into a computer, I think. So fortunately, hopefully in my lifetime, that's going to be the case, but probably in the future.
I guess it can't fear it's going to make a mistake either.
Exactly.
Right? Which is probably important. Mark, what about human enhancement? And you mentioned already the sort of the exoskeleton and these extraordinary developments. Give us a time frame. You talk about a solution within lifetimes. Is it still untapped to a degree? And if we had a more committed allocation of resources, could we see more developments more quickly? Presumably that's part of what you lobby for.
Yeah, well, I have been struggling to articulate an answer to this type of question on all of our pitches. And about 2 weeks ago, a woman summed it up pretty nicely for me. I think she described it as how the money works in scientific breakthrough through to commercialization. And she kind of spoke about the idea that there's basic science and there's quite a lot of funding for that, even for a very early stage breakthroughs. Then when you apply that basic research into applied science, moving towards the middle section, the startup or the spin out, then you move to a growing company and then a mature company. There are different technologies, different scientific breakthroughs that have funding right throughout that life cycle, from basic research through to mature companies. And something like spinal cord injury paralysis research doesn't necessarily have money in all five of those pots. So there's basic research, there's applied research, there's less money in the startup phase, practically no money in the growth phase, and very little, there are very, very few mature companies. And we're working in this area between applied research and startup funding to try and help the scientists get their technologies out of the lab and into the clinic. But it's a question of how do you get. It's partly about storytelling. It's partly about emotion and nothing to do with the technology, because we've got to find people at this startup area that are excited enough about the technology and the potential impact on human beings, even if it's not $1 billion profit margin that they're going to find, if it's not $1 billion business, but they want to get in and they want to change people's lives. So I suppose it's only now that we're discovering where some of the barriers are, from scientific technology breakthrough through to commercialization, and working at the point where it needs more money to get to the next stage. So that's kind of where we're operating at the moment. And for a long time, we were scratching our heads thinking, well, why isn't electrical stimulation of the spine that allows people who are paralyzed from the neck down to move their hands and feed themselves? Why isn't that available in every clinic around the world for practically no cost? And it's because of just the life cycle of funding that, or the immaturity of the particular market that we operate in. But once you know what the problem is, you can start to go about fixing it.
Let's look to the future. I wanted to ask you, both of you, a little about what excites you? And I wonder, Lewis, you're talking earlier about your focus, your discipline approach to your racing. Does the future to you sort of begin and end with race one of 2019? I feel bad even asking you this, mm-hmm. as you're trying to look forward to enjoying your off season, but is that part of the discipline? You can't look further than that?
No, not at all. I think with age, you gain the ability to probably, I guess, be able to look at the short term and also the long term. But I mean, I'm looking for the long term at the moment. And what I currently work on, for example, for next year, that's really another stepping stone for something that I want to do in the future. But I still got to do the job, you know, Formula One. And the success that I have in that provides me a platform to do a lot of other things and really figuring out what I want to do beyond. Because, you know, I'm now the third oldest driver there is. So in Formula One, which is kind of ridiculous, I'm 33. But the thing is with sportsmen and women, a lot of them being that sport is what we've done our whole lives. A lot of them, as far as I'm aware and I know, a lot of them forget to plan for the future. So the career ends and it kind of comes to a halt. And you've done it your whole life. I've been racing since I was 8. So if I was to stop today and I hadn't planned, you'd feel like your life's coming to an end kind of thing. And you'd be sitting around twiddling your thumbs. So my game plan is really remaining fully focused on the present, but also super conscious that time passes quickly. And, you know, what can I do afterwards? And naturally for me, I want to have more of an impact. And when I say more of an impact, I think that's really, when you talk about paralysis, I think that's something that I'm quite intrigued by, because the mind is such a fascinating thing. And I think they said there was a billion sensors in the mind. Is it something that?
Yeah.
Which are still completely, you know, I feel like the understanding of the brain, it's so in its infancy still. And so I'm fascinated by the growth of that and the understanding of that. I think if you're able to understand and heal paralysis or cure paralysis, I think you're going to learn so much more about the brain, you know, because it's all connected to your nervous, you know, your central nervous system, which I'm, being that I'm working, I'm very, very grateful to obviously have the movement that I have. Mm. I'm fascinated by you, Mark, and same with like my brother and with Billy Munger, the kid I was telling you about earlier that lost his legs, and how he's, the mind's able to switch and focus on not what's behind, but what can I do moving forwards? How can I drive forwards and still achieve something? What, you know, that's something I'm, that's super inspiring for me.
And Mark, I almost can't follow that, but I guess, I don't know, maybe yours and Lewis' shared interests could meet down the line, it sounds like, because this commitment you have to finding a cure within your lifetime, clearly it sits with, you know, Lewis's fascination with science and the seemingly limitless possibilities of what can be done as we understand the brain. I don't know, you could be sitting together around a table like this one in 30 years talking about how you've cracked it. That's got to be the hope, right?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing which I think runs through all sports people that I talk to, and doesn't necessarily fit with the way everyone thinks. But I, about 2 weeks after my accident in intensive care, I'd just come back from the South Pole, and I was getting lots of messages saying things like, sorry to hear about your accident, but sort of, it's lucky it was you, because if anyone can deal with it, it's you. And I'm thinking, not so much, you know. You know, as I was sort of crying into my pillow, you know. But I wrote a blog, Total Stream of Consciousness, all dosed up on morphine for the pain. And it was titled Optimist, Realist, or something else, because I was trying to make sense of how I should respond to this. For the first 12 weeks after an accident, you've got spinal shock, so they don't know if you're really paralyzed or not, but deep down, you really know that you are. And I was thinking, you know, should I just think, oh, I'm just going to get better. I'm just going to get better. That's what the optimist would think. That would be the positive mental attitude approach. But the conclusion, if not at the end of that particular blog, but over time, was that, in fact, to be a realist, which is what most sports people are, you accept the brutal facts of the starting point, which for me was, I'm in intensive care, I'm pretty paralyzed here, and I might or might not get better. So the acceptance of the starting point married with some kind of hope for a better future. And if I extend that out now to what I'm doing, I've accepted that for me and for all the people around the world who are paralyzed, there is no immediate cure. That's the acceptance point. There is a life to be led with the injury if you have the right supports and access to healthcare and so on and so on. But there's a possibility on the hope side of the equation that we can cure paralysis in our lifetime with enough of the right support, with enough creative thinking around how this stuff's funded needs to be done creatively. It needs to be done with people from outside the expertise area coming in and shaking things up. So I'm not an optimist, but I think the mental strength that you talk about, Lewis, is in fact when we read stories of realists in sport, prisoners of war, people who have faced really difficult circumstances. I think all of those people who make it through are in fact realists. Definitely. Which is not as exciting or as upbeat as the optimist, but I think it's how we get through.
Definitely.
Well, that was two remarkable individuals, and it was an absolute pleasure to speak to them both and hear them share their insights. Our thanks to Mark Pollock and to Lewis Hamilton. If you want to find out more or learn about what you can do to support Mark's quest, then head to markpollocktrust.org. You can also discover more about Mark and the other amazing UBS Global Visionaries. Go to ubs.com and search Global Visionaries. And of course, you should head to MercedesAMGF1.com to follow the team's championship challenge this year and to track Lewis's fortunes as he bids for that sixth world crown. In the meantime, you can listen again and find out more about this programme at monocle.com or catch up via your preferred podcast platform, The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.